Today is September 20th, 2017, and this is episode number 428 of the Apple Context Machine, a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Jeff Gamet, managing editor at TMO, and I have a special guest with me today because we have locked Brian away. I mean, sent him on vacation again. Peter Cohen, how are you?
I am great. How you doing, Jeff?
I'm doing great. It's been forever since we've had time to chat, so I'm so glad you're available to join me today. And for those of you that don't know who Peter is, he is one of my favorite writers in the Apple tech community, and he's been doing this for years and years and years for all kinds of publication. You're freelance now, so if you want stellar writing, Peter's out there. Give him a call. Where can people find you, Peter?
My website is peter-cohen.com, and you can also find me on Twitter at Flarg, F-L-A-R-G-H.
Awesome. And thank you for being here. I really am glad that you're joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Jeff. This is the first time you and I have talked on this particular podcast, so this should be fun.
Yeah, it should be a lot of fun. And Brian's not around to get in our way, so we're just going to do as we please.
That's fine, because I'm just tired of his poopy pants. No, just kidding.
Yeah, well, yeah, he washes his pants, just so you know. Anyhow, I've talked with people on a bunch of different shows about their take on iOS 11, and we haven't done that here yet because iOS 11 just came out a couple days ago. And I'm curious, what are you thinking about this, Peter?
You know, iOS 11, for all of the iOS updates I've lived through, and I've lived through most of them, iOS 11 has been the smoothest, I think, that I can really remember. I had absolutely no problem updating devices to the latest version. I had no problem getting watchOS on my original Apple Watch. Mm-hmm. So I kudos to Apple for what I thought was a pretty seamless first day update for iOS 11. Now, as you point out, Jeff, as we're recording this, we're only a couple of days into it. So, you know, who knows if there are any big scary monsters under the bed. But so far, so good. I'm pretty impressed. I have an older device that I'm using as my daily driver, my iPhone 6 Plus, mm-hmm. and it's working with iOS 11 just fine. Mm-hmm. You know, so far, so good.
You know, I tested... I ran the developer beta on a 6 and 6 Plus, and then right at the end, I put it on my 7, which is my daily driver phone. And it's been running great on all the devices. The biggest issue that I had was that on the 6 Plus, I believe. No, 6. There were some weird redraw issues where you'd rotate the screen and stuff wouldn't show up what it was supposed to. And sometimes you'd have like part of the passcode pad cut off and, you know, just weird things like that. But I'm chalking most of that up to beta. And overall, I've been very pleased with this release.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think standard rules apply, though, in all cases. So if you haven't already upgraded to iOS 11 and you're kind of on the fence about doing it, make sure to back up your stuff first. You know, make sure to back up not only using iCloud backup, but also backing up locally to your computer using iTunes, because mm-hmm. that way you've got two copies. You've got one copy in the cloud and you've got one copy on your machine. So if anything goes wrong, you'll be able to restore. And actually, I did run into a problem that was my own fault when I started upgrading, because mm-hmm. I really prefer to do it from a Mac instead of doing it from over the air on the device. Simply because you don't have to cache the installer on the device. You don't have to wait for it to move around all those files. You can kind of let your Mac do the heavy lifting there. The only problem is if you're, you know, doing something silly and you jostle the cable around, the lightning cable, all of a sudden you'll brick your iPhone. You'll turn it into DFU mode.
Oh.
You know, you'll get that flashing world icon on the screen. That actually happened to me, but it was seriously like 2 minutes to get back to where I was in terms of restoring and updating. But it was a little bit scary at first. And when I used to work in an Apple, a third party Apple retail store. And would help customers with their iPhones all the time. And this is probably the number one issue that comes up when people update. Something goes wrong during the update process and the phone gets bricked and they don't know what to do. So being able to do it locally lets you be able to restore from that really quickly and get back on your feet. But having a having an updated backup is the most important thing.
Yeah, I'm with you. And even though I had no troubles at all with the backups, and even going from backups to the general release, or excuse me, going from betas to the general release, I still had backups all the way through because you never know. And I'd rather have them and not need them than get caught without.
Absolutely. Yeah, you never want to get caught without a life preserver when you're all of a sudden find yourself floating in the water.
Yeah, that would be a bad thing. So, what are you liking about iOS 11?
Well, you know, the new control center is really cool. Just visually, iOS 11 is easier for my middle-aged eyes to read than iOS 10 was. I can see fonts more clearly.
Buttons are more prominent.
Buttons are certainly more prominent. So, you know, the whole user interface for iOS 11 has gotten a nice pop to it. I often do tutorials and screenshots so I can show people stuff on my iPhone as well. And iOS 11, this is really kind of inside baseball, but it's my favorite feature for myself so far. Mm-hmm. iOS 11 introduces a new screenshot mechanism. Now, you know, since it was introduced, you've been able to take a screenshot by holding down the home button and then hitting the power button. Mm-hmm. And that will save it to your camera roll. But now it actually redraws the screenshot as a thumbnail, and it puts it in one corner of the screen. And if you tap on it, then you can edit it using built-in markup tools. So you can immediately add like a magnifier to it, or you know, you can put a red marker around an icon that you want to show off to somebody, or whatever other edit you want to make. And that is just such a fabulously cool little feature for me. I just love it to death.
You know, it's one of those features that I've been using for months now, because I'd take a screenshot, I'd mark it up, and then send it off to someone else and say, are you having the same bug? And then also using the video screen capture thing. So I could show when like a redraw thing wasn't happening right, or something else wasn't doing what I expected. Or I needed to demonstrate, here's how to make this thing happen. Yeah, that video screen capture thing is just awesome too.
I like the new interface for the App Store, although the icon for the App Store confuses me a little bit, because it looks more than ever like somebody's popsicle stick project. But the App Store interface changes are very welcome. They make it much nicer to kind of explore and discover new things than it used to be. And of course, files. You know, files is really cool as well. If you're like me and you rely on iCloud Drive to keep track of files in the cloud.
Oh man, files! That has turned out to be just huge for me, bigger than I expected. And I do a lot of stuff with iCloud Drive. I also have stuff in Dropbox.
Yep.
And and I'm also a transmit user, because I still do a lot of stuff that involves having to FTP. So I have transmit everywhere. And with one of the later updates with transmit, it added in file support. So it just showed up for me in the files app, which means that now if I want to, I can do FTP stuff in the files app as well.
I didn't realize that you could do that in the Files app. That's really cool. That is really nifty.
Yeah, I didn't know either until it just showed up. And man, that was just fantastic. So one of the things that I've been playing a lot with is the split screen multitasking sort of stuff on my iPad. And excuse me, I'm curious, are you playing with that? What do you think about it?
You know, this is the really interesting thing for me. You know, I think that a lot of us who are predominantly iPhone users, or maybe exclusively iPhone users, are missing the bigger picture here. And that is that iOS 11, as cool as it is to use on any supported device, iOS 11 is really pushing the iPad forward as a general computing device more than any other iOS release I can remember. Now, you know, Apple has long articulated a philosophy of, you know, there are all sorts of different devices to, or different cars for us to drive on the internet. You know, that some of us are going to like pickups, some of us are going to like some subcompacts. There's always going to be a place for computers like the Mac. There's always going to be a place for phones. There's always going to be a place for iPads. But blurring those lines is really what Apple has specialized in doing for the last several generations of not just iOS, but macOS, sort of seamlessly working out the kinks in workflow. So your data, your workflow just happens regardless of what device you're using. I start an email on my iPhone while I'm commuting, and I go to my office and my Mac knows that there's an email open and lets me continue. You know, the continuity lets me do that. There's handoff technology that really facilitates this. I'm not connected to Wi-Fi. Oh, I can use my iPhone as a hotspot with my cell phone service provider, and it's just there. You know, I don't have to go through any weird permutations to get it to work. I don't have to flip any switches. I can see it in my list of available devices. I select it, and off I'm off to the races. iOS 11 does this for the iPad in a very fundamental way with the feature that you were just talking about and some other stuff to make it a lot easier for people to use the iPad, and especially the iPad Pro, as a general purpose computing device the same way that they might use a Mac. So that is very exciting and I think incredibly important for Apple.
Oh, man, I'm so with you. So for me, on day one of developer beta one, I put that on my iPad mini. That's my sacrificial device. And it was fine and it worked well. And as the betas progressed, I kept feeling like, man, there's so much I can do with this, but the screen is too small for the things that I really want to be doing. And finally, it was probably around beta 4, I decided that I was going to go ahead and put it on my iPad Pro, which for me is a mission-critical production machine. But I went ahead and did it, and holy crap, it completely changed my tablet experience for me. And by the time we got to the general release, we've hit the point where, except for the fact that I have to record podcasts, I can actually do everything that I need to do on an iPad Pro.
And if you take a look at the hardware that Apple's put in the new iPhone X, the iPhone 8 and 8 Plus, you know, this A11 Bionic chip. Mm-hmm. We're talking about a chip that computationally outperforms the MacBook Pro in some respects. So, the next generation of devices that we're going to see from Apple are more and more moving into the realm of devices, mobile devices that can completely replace our desktop or laptop systems. It's an exciting time. Now, having said that, look, I'm a 30-year Mac user, right? I'm not getting rid of my Mac anytime soon, and I'm not suggesting anybody else do it either. Because quite frankly, the workflow still isn't there, Jeff. I use an iPad Pro, even with a keyboard, and I still get really frustrated trying to do simple things that I just take for granted that are muscle memory to do on the Mac. Mm-hmm. I don't want Apple to completely replace the user experience of the iPad with the user experience of the Mac. I don't want the iPad to be a Mac. In the same token, I don't want to have to relearn how to do things on the iPad as well. And that's always prevented the iPad from being a complete computer replacement for me. But look, I admit I'm an old man yelling at clouds here, yelling at iClouds, if you will. I am probably not ever going to make that transition, but I can certainly understand and appreciate people who maybe are a little bit more flexible and are willing to do that because they're going to have a great experience with the iPad Pro.
You know, when I say my iPad Pro could replace my MacBook Pro, except for podcasting, of course it comes with some caveats because there are many things that are just faster and easier to do on the Mac because of the way the interface works. But being able to do split screen mode on the iPad has proven to be so useful for me that more often than not, that's probably what I'm doing. And having the drag and drop between apps on the iPad, that has become incredibly useful for me. So it addresses one of the issues that I had before, which is how do I get stuff from here over to here? Well, now I can just drag and drop. And I'm loving all those things. That said, most everything I do today, I can do faster on my Mac, but I can see a day where at some point down the road where there will be an iPad that conceivably could replace my laptop. I don't know if I wanted to, but it could.
Yeah. What's more, I mean, you know, you got to bear in mind that, you know, that there's generations now of computer users who've come up behind you and me, for whom a smartphone is their primary device and may actually have been their first, you know, initial experience on the internet and trying to do computational work, whatever they're doing, whether it's editing images or whether it's writing stuff down or what have you. So, you know, bringing those features to iOS, I think makes a lot of sense strategically from Apple to keep the interest of people who are accustomed to that kind of interface and that kind of workflow.
Yeah, that makes sense. There's a whole generation where if you say, what's the first computer you used? The answer is going to be iPhone. And unlike us, where the answer for me is a Commodore PET 2001 with a cassette tape for data storage.
That's exactly right. You know, it's funny. I was thinking about this the other day. My first personal computer experience was a TRS-80 Model 1.
Oh, I remember those.
And, you know, when it was cutting edge at the time, man. I mean, you know, Radio Shack is a punchline now, but,
not back then.
Not back then, man. They were like one of the premier, they were for a while, the biggest provider of personal computers in the entire US market. It was crazy. They were bigger than Apple. IBM was nowhere around. I mean, there was no such thing as a PC compatible at the time.
Right.
You know, when you go from those really primitive devices to where we are now, it's incredible. Just in the last 5 years, even the changes that we've seen are remarkable. But I think we've lost something in the process too. You know, as slick and as computationally intensive as these new devices get, mm-hmm. we're all users. You know, we're all consumers of apps, of services, of technology. And we can do incredibly sophisticated things, but our actual understanding of what's going on under the hood has evaporated.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I hadn't thought about that, but that's true. When I got my Franklin Ace 1000, that was my Apple IIe clone, in the box, there was a book that had all these fold-out pages. It had all of the wiring schematics for the entire computer. Like, if you were patient enough and knew which places to go and buy parts, you could actually completely build your own computer from scratch just from the diagrams they had included with the computer. You never see stuff like that now.
No, you never do. It's too bad. But, you know, on the other hand, not everybody needs to be a programmer, right? That was at a time when the people who were buying these computers were hobbyists and were, mm-hmm. you know, software engineers and computer engineers, systems analysts who were just interested in having a computer at home because it was a novelty and it was something that they could do. It wasn't, you know, everybody had a computer and it was just expected that you were going to be able to you know, to connect to the internet or do whatever it was that you were going to do on a computer. It was a very different time.
It was a very different time. Yeah. Oh, good times. I used to be able to hum all of my, modem handshake tones.
Yeah. Yeah. The good old days. Dial up.
No kidding. You know, this is like the most fun iOS 11 discussion I've had with anyone so far. I just have to tell you.
So, yeah, you know, iOS 11 on the iPad is really cool. Drag and drop is awesome. Have you found some apps don't support it, though?
Yeah. I wasn't sure if it was apps that weren't really supporting it, or if I was having issues with beta releases. But yeah, occasionally I'll come across an app where drag and drop just doesn't work. But it hasn't been as much of a problem the closer we get to the closer we got to the Gold Master.
Yeah, I mean, the problem that I think that we're seeing is that some apps anyway haven't been yet optimized for iOS 11. You know, Apple laid down the guidelines for this at WWDC, and that simply wasn't the time frame that some developers needed to make the changes to their code to get their apps well optimized for iOS 11. You can armchair quarterback their decision or their own programming schedule for doing so. You know, some people, for example, are criticizing Microsoft for not having and Adobe for both sort of throwing up red flags about High Sierra compatibility in their respective packages. But look, you know, these foundational changes to operating systems bring with them a certain amount of challenge for developers. So sometimes we have to be a bit patient.
Yep. So it's coming. And like I said, the apps that I've encountered that didn't handle drag and drop well, that number's dwindling by the day.
So, you know, one of the other things I noticed about iOS 11, which is really kind of curious, Jeff, is that it's in the way that Apple is marketing it. And what I mean is that if you take a look at Apple's marketing page for iOS 11 on its website, it talks about the things that you can do with Siri. Mm-hmm. Naturally more helpful is their tagline. And, you know, you can use it for translation. You can use it as a personal DJ. And I think that this is really interesting because this is a little bit of a different take or interpretation on Siri than what we've heard from Apple in the past. You know, we've always sort of associated Siri as a natural language assistant. You know, you click and hold the home button, or you yell, you know, that particular phrase that I won't yell in case anybody's got it active. Mm-hmm. And Siri pops to life and you can interact with it. The interesting thing for me is that Siri, beyond just having a more expressive, natural voice, Apple's also using Siri as being associated with QuickType. So, you know, as you're typing out a message to somebody, QuickType is, you know, is a Siri thing now. You're figuring out predictive text, in other words. Mm-hmm. Safari. Siri now suggests searches in Safari based on what you were just reading. This isn't Siri in the same way that, you know, we've been thinking about Siri for the last few iOS releases. This is machine learning just in general as a function of iOS. That's Siri as far as Apple is concerned. Siri is anything to do with iOS getting to know you better and customizing content based on what it thinks you need.
So just to make sure I've got this straight, Siri is now seen as a machine learning system as opposed to a voice interface.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
Okay. All right. Well, that's actually pretty profound. That tells me that Apple has really big plans for what they're doing with this, and the voice part is just a small component in the whole thing.
Well, let me read you what exactly Apple says in its marketing materials. It says, smarter about you, smarter for you. Siri has always been more than a voice. See right there, Apple's rewriting history. Well, okay, but you haven't really made a big deal about it before now, Apple. Yeah. You're right, you know, because Siri has been more than a voice for a very long time. When I got my Apple Watch and I discovered that I could add things to the shopping list, you know, that I keep in my reminders app. Mm-hmm. You know, okay, well, that's when I describe it to people, what I'm doing is I'm telling Siri I want to add butter to the shopping list, and it does it. But that really hasn't, I mean, like before, you might have quibbled as to whether or not that's really a Siri thing, right? That's a dictation thing. You know, I'm holding down the Siri button to make it happen, but is that really Siri or is that just dictation? Or, you know, that's another good example, dictation. You know, am I using Siri when I'm using dictation? So Apple is trying to blur the line here, and Apple is saying, look, Siri's more than just this nice voice that you talk to. or that talks to you, that makes the, this voice that comes out of your Mac, your iPhone, or your iPad. Siri is everything about iOS 11 that is, that learns from you and learns to anticipate what you're looking for and, you know, kind of reduces friction in your life. And of course, that is key. That's key to everything that Apple does, is that it wants to reduce the amount of friction in our lives when it comes to getting information, doing things, you know, committing to actions, doing whatever it is that we're doing with our devices, whatever it can do to lessen the friction there and make it easier. Apple wants us to do that.
Okay. So, I'm just sitting here thinking about all these people that I've encountered that say serious crap, Amazon, Alexa is so much better. Siri is so stupid. Apple has lost the game. What do you think?
I'm not going to disagree with any of them. I don't mean about the Apple losing the game part, but about Siri being crap. Siri, Alexa, Cortana, Google, it doesn't matter what you're using. All of these machine learning systems have huge, like 6-lane superhighway flaws in them and problems. You know, like contextualization is almost impossible. You know, what was that song that you played two songs ago? Siri doesn't know what the heck I'm talking about.
Right.
You know, there are conversations that you can have with a 3 or 4 year old child that you can't possibly have with Siri because the AI, quote unquote, just isn't that sophisticated yet. The heuristics that they're using are just not, the algorithms that they've developed are not that great yet, but it's a work in progress. Now, before iOS 11 was released, I had read a lot of stuff going into it saying, yeah, Siri sounds a lot better in iOS 11, but really isn't that much smarter than it was before. So Apple has certainly put lipstick on that pig, you know, a very nice new, very, you know, on trend color of lipstick, but it hasn't really addressed the underlying AI issues yet. Look, this is an infant technology for everyone who's in the market right now. And just because it's populated by Amazon and Microsoft and Google and Apple doesn't mean that it's robust technology. Having said that, I think it's here to stay. And I've gotten a lot more comfortable with it than I did at first. I had a very adversarial relationship with Siri at first, like, oh, this is a gimmick. I'm not going to use this. And over time, it's sort of worked its way insidiously into what I do. So, you know, for example, when I drive now, I don't even think about touching my phone unless I really have to. I just bring my Apple Watch up to my lips, hit the digital crown and tell it what I want to listen to or where I want to go or whatever else I need. So my eyes are on the road where they should be and not on my device. The shopping list is another really practical example of that. You know, that's something that I do just by muscle memory at this point. You know, stand in front of the fridge or in front of the cabinet and, okay, well, I need this, that, or the other thing. I add it to my list. I go to the grocery store, pull up my list on my watch or on my phone, and it's all right there, just as I dictated it to Siri. So the Siri's ability and all Apple technology's ability, I think, to sort of reduce the friction in our lives when it comes to just doing what we want to do is really important. And it's something that I think fundamentally differentiates how they do it from the way that other companies do it. I'm just hoping that over time they'll, you know, double down and make Siri even smarter than it is now.
Well, the way I see it, this whole voice interface, artificial intelligence thing that we have going on right now is still in the very, very early stages, you know, like early infancy stages. So there's all these big limitations and frustrations, but then a lot of things are changing quickly because they're growing and developing these systems. And what I've experienced, because I have an Amazon Echo Dot in my place, and then of course all these iOS devices, I get to play with Siri and Alexa at the same time, and it just feels like the two companies have completely different philosophies on how this technology should work. So with the Echo, I have to learn the right words to say in the right order to make the thing happen. And with Siri, it feels more like I get to say the thing I want to say, and it's figuring out what I want it to do. And whoops, and I just woke Siri up. And it just, yeah, so it feels to me like right now, it's as if they're on parallel courses, but I don't think they really are. I think they're diverging. And what I'm hoping is that because Apple is taking this approach where Siri needs to learn what to do for us as opposed to us needing to learn what to do for Alexa, that we're going to have a very different experience with this over the next few years.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think that evolution is inevitable and evolution is happening quickly on this stuff. But there are also some practical ethical considerations that we have to give as well. You know, a lot of hay has been made, for example, with the Echo and the Echo Dot about how Google is always on. It's always listening. And in fact, you can look for yourself inside the Alexa app on your iPhone at what Alexa is hearing and how it is responding to you. You know, it keeps a running list of all the commands that it thinks it hears and what its actions as a result of that are. It's disturbing to think that this information is in the cloud and out of our control, especially if you're concerned about the privacy and integrity of your data. So there are practical ethical considerations to how this technology works, which we don't talk about very frequently, but I think are very important, especially going forward. Now, to that end, I am less concerned about what Apple is doing with that metadata that they're collecting from errant Siri activations than I am with Google. Or with Microsoft, because Apple has a much better track record of protecting the integrity of and the privacy of its customers' data than a lot of other companies do. Having said that, this is very much in play right now, and ethicists and technologists alike are scratching their chins, wondering what's going on here.
Yeah. And my guess is at some point we're going to see more of this legislated because law enforcement would love to be able to use these devices as wiretaps. And so we're going to have to sort out what's okay, what's not, what is admissible in court, what's not, and just how far the government can go into listening and how far companies should be able to go into listening and into our lives.
Yeah, but having said that, I've seen a lot of wild-eyed FUD over the past few days about Face ID. You know, on the iPhone X, and one of the craziest conspiracy theories I read actually was on Wired of all places, outlining some theoretical possibility where the feds force Apple to upload all Face ID information to a central database so they can turn it over, so the government can build a face database of all iPhone 10 users. And I was thinking to myself, okay, if you had bothered to read Apple's white paper on the way that Secure Enclave works, which is a public-facing document that you can find with a simple Google search, you would understand that that is technically impossible for Apple to do. Apple, the data is on your device. It is encrypted.
The only place it is. It's on your device.
It is encrypted and locked to your device. You know, so even if somebody took that data off of that chip, they wouldn't be able to do anything useful with it. And by the way, Face ID and Touch ID you can't build a fingerprint database or a face database, whatever the hell that might be, out of that information. The data that they're collecting and the way that they're processing it is much, much different.
Yes, you know? That's true. They're not storing images of your fingerprints or images of your face. They're storing strings of numbers that are generated from algorithms related to information that's collected from scanning your fingerprints or your face.
Right, exactly. So, you know, just the amount of just wild-eyed, like, tin hat-wearing FUD I see about privacy when it comes to Apple products in particular is really appalling. And I'm just angry when I read about this stuff.
Yeah, I'm with you. And had I not seen the Wired article when you started talking about it, my first assumption would have been, okay, you're trying to trigger me and see if I'll go crazy on the show.
Well, you know me, Jeff, I can always find something to get upset about. You know, getting upset about things is my stock and trade. But no, this one was definitely just lunacy.
Yeah. I'm kind of shaking my head here because, you know, it's an audio podcast. So shaking my head is going to do so much good. Yeah. All right. So you've been like big into backup for a long time.
Yeah. You know, losing your data like in really horrendous ways and eating crud as a result of it mm-hmm. makes you kind of hyper paranoid of making sure that your data is safe. But yeah, you're right. I've done stints at backup companies and I'm a big believer in the backup.
And which is one of the reasons I'm glad you're here today, because I've talked with many people about this whole HFS plus to APFS transition and what it means for your data. But because of your background and your passion, I thought it'd be awesome to get your take on this too.
Well, okay. Yeah, I'm happy to. APFS is coming to Macs with High Sierra. It's actually, it's really interesting. APFS is, of course, Apple's new file system, and it's Apple's next generation file system. The file system that Apple had been using up until now was essentially unchanged for pretty close to two decades. It was, you know, something that Apple developed way back when people were still using floppy disks and, you know, hard disk drives were getting larger but weren't even close to the capacity that they are now. Right. And it was long before, you know, devices went solid state and everything. So, APFS changes that. APFS is a thoroughly modern file system that is designed especially for all of the flash storage-based devices that have become such an important part of Apple's product line. And APFS was available initially only if you were a Mac developer. So Mac developers got first crack at kind of putting APFS through its paces, which is really ironic because APFS actually ended up coming to iOS first. APFS was released as a or was released in an iOS 10 update that came out earlier this year, and everybody's device just automatically reformatted itself to APFS, and nobody had problems. At least there weren't really any big problems that I'm aware of.
I don't know of any either.
So that was seamless, and now APFS is also coming to the Macintosh, but there's a hitch. APFS is only going to be available on High Sierra on day one if you're using an SSD-based Mac. So if you're using an older Mac that's compatible with High Sierra but doesn't have an SSD in it, if it's using a spinning hard disk drive like, you know, a common field hand might do, mm-hmm. It is going to stay on HFS Plus. If you have an iMac with a Fusion drive inside, it is going to stay on HFS Plus. So APFS is not coming to all Macs on release day for High Sierra, only those with SSDs.
Okay. Now, I've gone through the transition to APFS on my test Mac. And then, of course, all of my iOS devices did the transition totally transparently. I've had no trouble at all. Everything is working just fine, to the point that if I didn't know that I had an APFS formatted device, I just simply wouldn't know. And I think that's great. So,
and that's exactly what you want, a transition like this to have happen, because you know, if this wasn't as seamless as it is, Apple would be unleashing hell on millions of people. A new file system is a major foundational change for an operating system. You know, it's a huge, huge change to the way that data is written to those devices. So the fact that it is as seamless as possible is a very good indication that Apple's handling this transition well.
Yep, I've been very pleased. So one thing that I learned about APFS was at Worldwide Developer Conference. I was at Gruber's talk show event that he did live, and he was talking with Phil Schiller and Craig Federighi. And one of the things that Craig said was when they did this test for the transition on iOS into APFS, they had been doing it since early versions of iOS 10. And what they would do is they would do the conversion, and then right at the point where they have to commit, they'd roll it back. So they've been converting our data to APFS for several updates without anyone even knowing. And then it wasn't until the one update where they said, okay, here's where it's actually happening, that they did the commit. So the fact that they'd been able to test it so much and no one even knew, that, I mean, that was really impressive.
Seriously. And, you know, it, again, like I said, they could unleash hell if they handled this wrong. So I'm glad to see them spend so much time and so much effort getting it right.
Yeah, me too. But one place where I do see hell being unleashed potentially is with backups. I mean, when you start talking about different file systems, things can change with your backups. And I'm betting you have some insight on that for me.
Well, you know, it's interesting because Apple actually has published a tech note on its website for system administrators and IT people who are managing the High Sierra update. And what they've said is that you don't need to make any change to Time Machine, for example, to back up an APFS formatted disk. But the difference is that Time Machine SharePoint. So if you've got like a NAS, a network attached storage device on your network that's sharing a Time Machine backup volume, it's got to be shared over SMB as opposed to AFP, because AFP has been deprecated with APFS. So you've got to use SMB, which is the way that Apple wants things to connect now. So that's one important thing. But, beyond that, I'm not seeing a huge amount of problems right now.
And it just occurred to me, there might be some people that don't know what you're talking about when you say SMB. So what exactly is that?
What is SMB? SMB is a very commonly used protocol for reading and writing files over a network. It's the server message block protocol. SMB has increasingly, in the last several releases of macOS, been the preferred way that Apple wants devices to communicate over the network. It basically is a protocol that lives on top of the TCP/IP protocol that all devices that are connected to the internet communicate through. So if you're running a NAS and you've got an older NAS system and you set it up using AFP, not SMB, you might want to go back and check with your company that you've got that NAS from, whether it's QNAP or Synology or whoever else, to make sure that you're doing the right thing before you make the High Sierra update. And again, to go back to what I was saying before, backup, backup, backup. And backup, don't just backup using Time Machine. Backup to the cloud as well. I don't care what service you use. You can use dedicated backup service like Carbonite or Backblaze. You could use iCloud Drive. You could use Dropbox Pro. You could use Microsoft OnePoint or whatever the heck it's called, OneDrive or whatever the heck it's called now. As long as your critical data is not just locally on a disk that's connected to your computer, but also in the cloud, you'll be able to restore no matter what happens. You definitely want to make sure that your data, any data that you care about, whether that's photos, contact information, tax returns, critical documents, insurance policies, whatever, make sure that stuff is backed up safely before you update, because you don't want to get caught with your pants down.
Not like that, anyhow.
No.
No. Now, do you have any perspective on APFS backups for bootable disks, or is that still something that's like totally up in the air and no one knows what's going on?
I have no idea what's going on there, Jeff. I got to admit, the whole APFS boot volume thing, I believe... Yeah, I think that was fixed over the summer, but I'm not positive.
Yeah, and your reticence to say, yeah, it's totally fixed, I totally get it. Because from what I've been hearing, there's all kinds of questions in the backup app developer community as to how this is really working. And some of it they've kind of had to guess at, and they've been waiting for High Sierra to roll out so they can actually test stuff. And it sounds like right now it's kind of just up in the air. So my feeling is, based on what I'm hearing today, is that you shouldn't look at APFS as a bootable backup system, but as a robust You shouldn't look to APFS if you are expecting to have a bootable backup, but it's fine if you're looking to have all of your data backed up.
Right. The other thing that I would add to what you just said, Jeff, is that no one needs High Sierra and an APFS file system conversion on day one, right? Well, some of us do. You do, I do, because we write about this stuff for a living. But if you're just listening to this podcast, or just happen to be a Mac enthusiast, and you're really excited about getting High Sierra, let me throw out a potentially heretical suggestion. Don't. Wait. You don't need High Sierra on day one. Let other people fall on the early adopter sword. You know, let them uncover the monsters under the beds that are going to bite everybody else. And that way, at least you know what to avoid. But there's a lot of questions that we've got that haven't been answered yet and probably won't be answered until this stuff's out in the wild.
Yep. And I'm with you. It's my job to rush in where angels fear to tread so that you don't have to.
And believe me, we've got the scars to prove it, don't we, brother?
Boy, howdy. Oh, man. Yeah. So we still have a few minutes left, and I wanted to get your take on the whole T-Mobile thing with iPhones and LTE and the whole 71 thing. Oh, my God, our devices aren't going to work.
Oh,
what
yes.
What are people talking about?
So a little interesting kerfuffle came up as soon as Apple announced the iPhone 8, 8 Plus, and iPhone 10. People took a look at the tech specs page on Apple's website and noticed that band 71 was not there. Oh, no. This is important for a certain subgroup of people in the United States, like me, who are T-Mobile subscribers. Now, T-Mobile, one of the most exciting telecom companies in the country. And how many telecom companies can we actually be excited about, right? John Ledger gets up on stage, you know, he's got kind of his long hair and his dirty mouth, and he's kind of rock star-y, and he's always like throwing shade at Verizon and AT&T. You know, they've got this young, scrappy upstart image, and it's really cool and everything. The only problem is their coverage is garbage if you get outside of urban areas. You know, if I go to Boston or Providence, which are the two biggest cities near me, I've got five bars of LTE all day long, fast as hell. I love T-Mobile up there, but in my neighborhood, T-Mobile's garbage. It's so bad that I've got a cell spot in my house that they sent me because I can't get signal inside my house. I couldn't get signal inside my house for the longest time on some of our older devices that also wouldn't work with Wi-Fi calling.
Oh, yeah.
So you know, it's one of those things where T-Mobile has been building out its network and has been doing a great job, but is fundamentally hampered by the technology it uses. Because you see, T-Mobile in the U.S. broadcasts all of its radio signals between – not all, but most of its radio signals between 1700 and 2100 megahertz. This is the same frequency band that Sprint uses. And we all know how awful Sprint's coverage is.
Yep.
Sprint and T-Mobile use two different kinds of radio technology. T-Mobile uses GSM, the same kind of technology that AT&T uses. Sprint uses CDMA, the same kind of technology that Verizon uses. But you can see Verizon's coverage is ubiquitous. Sprint's coverage is lousy. Why is that? Those frequencies have a lot to do with it. Because it turns out 1700 to 2100 megahertz, those radio signals don't permeate building walls nearly as good as the lower frequency 700 megahertz.
Okay.
And they also don't go as far from the radio tower as 700 megahertz does. So when you get to an area like mine, I live about an hour and a half outside of Boston. Coverage is inconsistent. I get no carrier. I get edge. It's awful. Well, A few years back, T-Mobile made a deal with Verizon to buy a block of 700 megahertz spectrum that they weren't using, what's called A-band spectrum. And that's LTE band 12. And that really helped them improve their coverage in some areas. So that came out before Apple announced the iPhone 6. And when I got my iPhone 6, I was so excited thinking that I was going to get this new fancy T-Mobile coverage. And it turned out that it didn't have band 12 in it. And I called up T-Mobile and I'm like, and I was like, well, why? And their answer was, well, you have to ask Apple why, but you know, the bottom line is we're supporting it, but the support in the phones isn't there yet. And it really isn't Apple's fault, it turns out, because very few companies at that point had LTE band 12 coverage. It took about a year, even about a year and a half before everybody got on board. Mm-hmm. Fast forward to today. The same thing happened when Apple introduced the iPhone 8 and the iPhone 10. A lot of T-Mobile users had heard earlier this year that T-Mobile was rolling out 600 megahertz coverage. Well, 600 megahertz, lower frequency still from 700. That means the coverage is going to get even better in ex-urban and rural areas served by T-Mobile. And inside of buildings. The only problem is, and T-Mobile said, hey, we're going to get this online by the end of the year. And they've already got a couple of test markets rolled out. That's cool. The only problem is that unless you live in the middle of nowhere in upstate Maine or in downeast Maine or somewhere in Montana, you're not in that test area to really benefit from this. So in other words, where people live, they're not using it yet. And you know what? It's going to take them 2 or 3 years to roll out. Apple will, in all likelihood, get LTE band 71 support into the next rev of its iPhones. I wouldn't be surprised if even the iPhone SE refresh, if one comes out early next year, might have that in it. It'll certainly be in whatever the fall parade of iPhones is. It's not in the iPhone 8 and the iPhone 10 because Apple already locked down the hardware spec on those devices months and months ago, including the radio chips that they were going to use. Mm-hmm. And those radio chips just simply don't have LTE band 71 in them. Now, people have said, well, can't you update the iPhone with new LTE service through some kind of firmware update? Yeah, you know what? No, it doesn't work that way. And the reason why is because you're dealing with another vendor's chips. Apple doesn't make the radio chips that it uses in the iPhone. But more importantly than that, there are also design considerations, practical considerations for how the antenna works, for example, how the device receives and makes calls that Apple is not going to mess with the firmware update. So no, your iPhone 10, if you've already, you know, committed $1,000 to that thing, is never going to work with LTE band 71. But your iPhone 10s or whatever comes out next year is going to support it. I almost guarantee it.
Okay, so the iPhones that people start buying in 2019 will very likely have LTE band 71 support.
No, 2018. I'm guessing that they'll have it.
Oh, that's right. This is not 2018 yet. Okay, so in 2018, those iPhones will likely have LTE band 71 support for T-Mobile, mm-hmm. And at that point, Apple may actually be ahead of T-Mobile because they're still in the process of testing, and they haven't even done an official rollout. And when they do that, it doesn't happen everywhere at the same time. It expands out gradually to different areas.
Yeah, and I think T-Mobile is focusing this rollout in ex-urban and rural areas where the coverage is hurting the most, because that's really where it comes up shortest against Verizon and AT&T. The fact of the matter is it's a lot more difficult for T-Mobile to do this than just flip a switch and yay, everybody's got 600 megahertz. They actually have to get people on towers, people that that aren't T-Mobile employees, to get up on towers that T-Mobile doesn't own, because there's an independent network of cell phone towers and tower operators all across the U.S., right? This is a very big, the telecom industry is a multi-billion dollar industry, a lot of moving parts in it. It'll take until 2020 or so before 600 megahertz is spread nationwide. And of course, by then, Verizon and AT&T, they're not sitting still either. They're improving their coverage. So everything I've just told you about is very specific to T-Mobile, very specific to the U.S. right now. But it is an interesting data point, and it is something that some people have been considering when they've been trying to decide whether or not to buy a new phone. From my perspective, I think there are a lot of other great reasons to buy those devices. I wouldn't hold up the purchase just for that.
You know, actually, I like that advice. Before you said that, I was thinking, all right, well, maybe if you're thinking you're going to hold on to your phone for 3 years and you really want that, then this isn't the right phone for you. But it doesn't matter because no one's got this yet. So buy the phone that you want today that does the things that you want today. And down the road, eventually you'll upgrade to a new phone. And at that point, it'll have band 71 if you're on T-Mobile. And maybe T-Mobile have coverage where you need it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I can count on one hand and still have enough fingers left over to hit my iPhone screen. The number of smartphones that have LTE band 71 support or will have LTE band 71 support and be available by the end of the year. So this is not an area where Apple is slacking or slacked off.
Okay, so would it be safe for me to say that this whole band 71 kerfuffle is kind of pointless because it just doesn't matter.
This band 71 brouhaha is just silliness.
All right. I like that. And, but I hope that they roll it out in your area sooner as opposed to later so that when you do get a iPhone with band 71 support, you have reasonable coverage. Finally.
Seriously, I'm sure that nobody wants that more than T-Mobile customer support because they're getting tired of my salty messages.
They should save them, play them at their Christmas parties.
I think they probably do.
Yeah, probably.
And hey, then throw darts at me.
Yeah, but hopefully love darts. And we're out of time, so we need to wrap up.
Okay.
And that's this week's Apple Context Machine. If you have anything to comment on, add, or question, write us at acm@macobserver.com. And hey, thanks for listening. Let's see our content. It's written by the good people at Mac Observer. Our bandwidth is provided by Cashfly. The bass is by Boom, recorded just for TMO. And that's all for this week. And please stay subscribed because we love every single one of you. Peter, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you very much, Jeff. I had a great time, man. Let's do this again soon.
Oh, absolutely. We totally need to do this. It's been so much fun. And you wrote an article on your own blog about Band 71. So I'll make sure there's a link to that in the show notes so people can go read that. And remind everyone again where they can find you.
Absolutely. You can find me at peter-cohen.com and also on Twitter at Flarg, F-L-A-R-G-H. If you've got any questions about Band 71 or anything else, just drop me a line. I'd love to hear from you.
Yes, and thank you again for being here.
Thanks again.
And listeners, thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week.